This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Tonight's final bout is for the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship, scheduled for one fall or to curfew.
From the Portland Sports Arena.
Wrestling fans, Bob Caudle and Johnny Weaver. Welcome to Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, the most exciting.
2-7 CFAC Calgary.
Once again, good afternoon, everyone. We're bringing you Mat Time action from the Victoria Pavilion in Calgary.
Batten down the hatches, and here we go. It's another edition of the Stampede Wrestling Show. Hi, everybody. It's me, still working on my Ed Whalen impression. It's Travis. Back here again with Kelly Nelson. We are looking at Stampede Wrestling a little further. This is part three of our History of Stampede Wrestling here on the Titans of Wrestling, Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. Kelly, how are you doing?
I'm great. Yeah, it's great to be back.
Yeah.
We've got a lot to talk about today.
Yeah. First, my initial disclaimer, I am woefully unprepared, but thankfully, Kelly's here to kind of lead the way, so I'll be listening along with the listener and hopefully not sounding like too much of a goon, but you know, trying to interject as much as I can. What we really wanted to do was talk about some specific wrestlers who were important to the territory, and we'll go into them in detail. Kelly's done some good research. And then finally, we'll finish with looking at a little bit of Dynamite matches, Dynamite Kid. Not so much in terms of biography, because I know there's already a lot out there, a lot people would be more familiar with than the guys that you're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, I guess I should plug that Lucha Afterground will be coming back in a couple weeks here. I don't know if anybody saw the trailer, but did you see the trailer? It looks outstanding, like all sorts of crazy questions. One thing I like about Lucha Afterground, Lucha Underground, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent here, but they are, I think, are the best at right now at hiding warts with spectacle or other kind of things. And Cobra Moon is not a good wrestler. I've mentioned this, I think. But they have a clip of her in this trailer where she's just sitting in like this serpent throne room that looks like right out of G.I. Joe and looks so good. And there's a whole bunch of little things like that. Yeah, exactly. So we're excited about that. But also on a side note, I want to mention a friend and like fellow big wrestling fan and former worker recently. As my friend Kevin Banner, he was involved in an ECCW angle recently with Ladies' Choice and Ravenous Randy Myers. He is also a really great stand-up comic, and he has coming out in 2 weeks from today. What's the date today? It is the 21st, so 2 weeks from today. He has his first album coming out on 604 Records, if you can believe it. The same, we won't get into who else they represent, but it's big time.
Big in Vancouver.
That's right. And his album, you'll like this, Kelly. I don't know if he'd been talking about title names based on wrestling, and he came up with Dreamboat, because he's a big Dusty fan, and
right.
I don't know how much of wrestling-themed content there will be, but I'm guaranteeing laughs, guys. So look it up. Kevin Banner, Dreamboat, should be available on iTunes in 2 weeks. Beyond that, Kelly, I'm sure you've got lots to push.
Yeah, maybe I'll save the plugs for the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we'll bookend it.
Yeah, we'll bookend it.
Sounds good.
Let's dive into it.
Fantastic. So I'll hand the reins off to you and try to keep up.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, this is a total monument to my ego as a wrestling historian. Yeah, I forced Travis to just take a back seat while I blather
Please.
On for who knows how long here. But, you know, the idea behind this was to, you know, cast light on guys that aren't too well known. You know, Stampede Wrestling in general amongst wrestling fans struggles to be accepted and to be known about. So there's guys in here that were big contributors to the history and were big stars, and they're total unknowns. And for me, you know, I'm big into the history, so here we go. Got a lot of history to talk about. I want to talk about guys like Sky High Lee, Sweet Daddy Siki, who's a name that I think some fans may have heard of, Dave Rule, and Dan Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
All four men equally important in the history of Stampede as far as making the territory hot, drawing money, and just being, you know, very popular over the years. So first, we'll go back, you know, as far as we can, or like this will be the earliest wrestler I talk about as far as the history of the territory. Early 50s era, before the television show even existed,
mm-hmm.
right? When Stu just had started promoting in Calgary,
mm-hmm.
he'd started kind of wetting his feet in promotion in Montana in the late 40s. And moved into Alberta shortly after. I plan on doing like a larger Stu Hart history of Calgary talk in a future episode, so I'll say that.
Cool.
Then, but in the early 50s, one of the main heels was Sky High Lee. And I kind of really fell in love with him just for his gimmick. He played a cowboy, but he was 6'8", or his build is 6'8".
Yeah.
So he was huge by the standards of the day, by the standards of today. The pictures you see of him, you know, he towers over everybody. He had a mustache, cowboy hat, basically like an evil cowboy. His gimmick. You were gonna say
Sky High Lee, the evil cowboy.
Yeah, like the name, you would think almost like a Japanese thing. But
I guess no. When you think about it, too.
Yeah,
sure.
L-E-E. Of course, in different cultures.
I think it's just because that there's when other wrestlers from Stampede era would have like names similar to that who would be
of Japanese wrestlers. And when I first saw the name, I think I just assumed mm-hmm. it was Japanese. And then when I started digging into it and finding out that there was more to this, and that it was an interesting. Gimmick, he was an interesting character.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before I do want to mention quickly, and looking at some of these, some of the footage, there's an early match of an unmasked Jushin Thunder Liger uh-huh. in Stampede Wrestling. If I don't know if many people knew that, but that was something to see. I was shocked that he had spent some time over. I mean, the guy's been everywhere.
Well,
but
Calgary was one of the places where the young boys of New Japan came
for their
learning excursions.
Sure, that makes sense.
Hirohase being another mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, I remember him. Sorry, mm-hmm. sorry.
Oh, no, no.
Digression.
It's Stampede. It's a territory with a lot of variety and a lot to talk about.
Cool.
But the character, like Sky High Lee, is like, I'm a big fan of the Dick Tracy comic strip. He would have been perfect as like a villain in Dick Tracy.
Huh.
Or like a James Bond villain, even.
Sure.
Kind of reminds me of the Jaws character.
I got you.
From 70s James Bond. He was born in Toronto, so he's Canadian. I have two dates, either 1924 or 1921. Wrestling most in the Midwest in 1944, where I first found results for him. He wrestled as Tiny Lee early on, which is a typical like play on someone that was, of course, tall.
Sure.
I found results of him as Sky High Lee in Winnipeg in 1945. He was mostly kind of, he was all over the place. He did a lot of wrestling on the West Coast, Montreal, Texas, in the Northeast, Toronto, down south in Georgia. But I think Calgary's maybe his top territory, his signature territory. In 1951, February 26th, he defeated Al Mills, who's a name that was big at the time, had wrestled in Calgary prior to Stu being a promoter for a lot of years, was a big name, and Lee defeated him for the Calgary version of the Canadian heavyweight title in Edmonton, which was the top belt in the territory at the time. Mills had actually held the title for, I believe, 4.5 years at that point, uninterrupted. Okay. So that was, you know, must have been a pretty big deal to end a reign that long. So this was 51-52. As far as I can tell, yeah, he was a pretty big heel at that time. Did really well. And he came back in 1955 and feuded with Fritz Von Erich.
Wow.
The father of the Von Erich boys.
Yeah.
Himself a huge, huge wrestling star. Played the evil Nazi gimmick. But this was apparently one of those, and we talked about this on the Stomper show last time, about like the Battle of the Monsters, Battle of the Heels. This was a Battle of the Heel type feud, apparently, with Von Erich and Sky High.
Great.
Probably a very interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, imagine the atmosphere in that room.
I mean, I guess Lee probably became the de facto face in that he was a cowboy and he wasn't a Nazi.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which would have been endearing.
That's all it takes. I'm looking at a really great picture of him and Sky High Lee and Brown Panther, who's a midget wrestler. Let's see if we can we'll post that on the PWO boards.
Yeah, that's what I want to do with a lot of these guys is put pictures out there to give you an image to go.
Yeah, yeah, he's got a great look. Yeah, it really cool.
So yeah, he, I think about 1956 was his last stay in Calgary. He spent the remainder of the 50s mostly on the West Coast, plus some in Hawaii and in Japan. And then he really faded away in the 60s. What I read online was that he had tax problems in North America and had to basically relocate to England. And he had some, like, you know, shady... It seemed like he lived a pretty tough life, probably a lot of drinking and that... And so the results I could find from the 60s were him in Germany, wrestling in Germany in 1961, and in Japan in 1968. So it's very foggy. Like, obviously, he probably wrestled more.
Sure.
He probably wrestled a lot in England, but results in the 60s are tough to find, it seems, for there. And he died in the early 70s, I believe, of alcohol sort of related issues.
Looks like
he would have been only 50, not even 50 at the time. And plus... I'm not sure if it was the height issue or, you know, how...
Not what Andre had.
They don't live very long.
Sure.
Yeah, that size. But anyway, yeah, he passed away early, but he was a definite, very important figure in 1950s Calgary wrestling.
Really archetypal when you think of the way they'd kind of build their guys.
Yeah, yeah, Calgary definitely.
Kind of naturally.
Yeah, they liked the monsters.
Or the cowboys even.
Yeah,
you know?
Cowboys,
I mean, that
too.
Feels like de facto in some way, as a heel or a babyface.
Yeah, yeah, worked both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's too bad we have... Nothing as far as I know, footage-wise.
From what you've looked up here, can you think of a modern-day comparison?
Jeez. The height and... Well, I mean, I'm thinking of someone like Big Cass recently, as far as like height goes and being athletic, sort of not too heavy or anything. Yeah, it's hard to say. Like, there isn't a lot of super tall guys left in wrestling.
It's true.
It's kind of
true.
Something that's gone away.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of the old sort of freak show spectacle of wrestling that we don't necessarily have.
God damn it, what the hell's happened to my company?
Much anymore. Yeah, gotta bring back the freaks. That'll turn things around. So next, Lee represented sort of the 50s. Now we'll move into the 60s for some important names. The first of which is a man called Dave Ruhl, who spelled R-U-H-L, who is really unknown. Even for me, I didn't really know a lot about him until recently. Again, the McCoy book, Pain and the Passion, is great for highlighting these guys. That's actually where I found a lot of this information.
Yeah, I saw.
That's basically the Bible for Stampede wrestling history. Rule was, his character was basically like a tough as nails pig farmer.
Yeah.
Originally, he was a heel.
He's billed as being from Hannah?
Yes, Hannah.
Is he legit? That's not, is that a shoot?
He was, yeah, no, it's legit.
Okay.
He was actually from Watts, Alberta, which is a very, very small town, I believe, near Hannah.
Hmm.
Hannah would have been like the hub of that area.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah, famous for being the birthplace of Lanny McDonald.
That's right, that's right.
The NHL and of our beloved Calgary Flames.
That's right. Hall of Famer.
And also the birthplace, unfortunately.
Of goes back to 604 Records.
Oh, really?
Nickelback, yeah.
Nickelback is on 604 Records.
Yeah, they are. Well, then that's CK's label. The only CK I recognize, Mr. Calvin Klein. I did a quick Google image search on Dave Rule. Not way less comes up than it did for Sweet Daddy CK. But he does look like, as you say, that kind of tough nails, a bit more like a pit bull.
Yeah, he was stocky.
Yeah.
So anyway, his bio is that he was born August 12th, 1920. So he's even older than Sky High Lee.
Hmm.
But
his time in Stampede came later?
Well, yeah, I'll get to that.
Okay.
He kind of was a little bit of a late bloomer into wrestling. He was working legit as a farmer, and he was discovered by famous wrestler Ray Steele, who was a name of note at that time, and may have been his uncle, even. There was kind of conflicting reports.
Sure. As is apt to happen.
When you go further into the past and when you're dealing with someone that hasn't been documented
at all. Yeah, and the kayfabe lines are a lot less, are a lot more blurry.
Yeah, so there's a lot of blurriness.
Yeah.
Anyway, Steele discovered him. He debuted in 1946. So this was a few years before Hart got involved in promoting. But he did wrestle at Stu's first Klondike wrestling show in Edmonton on September 11th, 1948,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of looked at as the birth of Stampede.
Okay.
Because that was, Stu's first, like, promoted show.
Yeah, you've mentioned Klondike, yeah.
Yeah. So his ties, Rule's ties to the territory go right back to the beginning. He wrestled in Montana a lot, which was a part of the territory at the time. And he was a heel, like I said, in the early days, rough looking. He was pretty much a mainstay in Calgary over the years, and he wrestled for a long time into the early 1970s.
Hmm.
He did travel to the USA on occasion, and that included working under a mask as the Hooded Wasp in the long-forgotten small-time Arizona territory, which is one of the, a very obscure territory.
Wow. Hey, so, that's not a name you hear
exactly. A lot. Yeah. It's a territory. I know little bits and pieces of it. It was a place where some people that did become big stars.
I was going to ask.
Out,
yeah. Okay.
But that's it. Like
Who are some of these names?
Billy Graham wrestled there, I think, before he'd wrestled even in Los Angeles.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if it was the same territory, but it was definitely in Arizona for a small promotion. I believe on a Native American reservation, if I'm not mistaken. With Jerry Graham as his sort of like manager tag partner.
Okay.
So a very obscure area. But like other than that, Rule was mostly in Calgary. He held the Canadian heavyweight title 8 times and the North American title twice. So the North American title was introduced in the late 60s. I believe we covered that in the Stomper episode. By 1964, he was a babyface because he entered into a legendary feud with another man that I'm going to highlight, Sweet Daddy Siki. This was like, you know, I can imagine just based on the personalities. First off, Siki was black. He had bleach blonde hair. He played up like the charisma, the outrageousness, played up on the racism of people in Calgary and Alberta at the time.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
He was like this proud black man that wasn't going to be held down or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you know, so he was a heel, of course.
Yeah.
But he was kind of like a black Gorgeous George, maybe in a way, or a black Freddie Blassie,
sure.
Buddy Rogers of that type of heel at the time. He got great heat and they had this feud that went on for off and on for years.
Cool.
with all kinds of crazy gimmick matches.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll get into a bit more.
These would be your main events on the card.
Yeah, I'm this guessing. Would have been the main event for sure. Rule was, by this time, you know, he had the legit roots of being from Alberta, being a farmer. So, you know, he appealed to the working class fans of Stampede. You know, there was a lot of examples in the territory days of that kind of babyface star in certain territories that basically was like a projection of the fans.
Great. Right? Yeah.
In Portland, they had Dutch Savage, for example, Tough Tony Bourne in Portland also, of like this tough, burly guy that, you know, kicked ass.
Joe the Plumber, just like you.
Yeah. So he was getting old, obviously, at this point. He was well into his 40s at this point. At 50 years of age, he was feuding with Abdullah the Butcher in 1970.
Yeah. Wow.
Someone who was, of course, no stranger to wrestling when he was quite old.
Yeah.
Later in his career. And then things really... Oh, and also, it needs to be mentioned that Rule was the booker.
I was going to say this. Yeah, it seems like I don't know if it was immediate after working that first Klondike show with Stu, but it sounds like he was like a really loyal soldier and like almost a right-hand man.
Yeah, I would say right-hand man.
Yeah.
I think him and Stu were quite close over the years. Actually, when he died eventually, Rule, in 1988, Stu went out of his way to go to his funeral on, like, you know, a minus 20, minus 30 day in December.
4 feet of snow every story,
no one else came from the wrestling business but Stu did, right?
Wow.
They were close. I want to say he started booking maybe in the late 50s, but I'm not sure the exact timeline. But he was the guy for a long time, coming up with these angles. In 1972, though, it kind of all unraveled for Rule. What happened was he got into a fight with the man who had become known as Carlos Colon,
very
famous wrestler, Puerto Rican star. Excuse me, yes, it's Calgary, it's Vancouver, it's Canada, we're drinking beer at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, I should mention, it's a beautiful, actually it's not that good. The last couple days have been gorgeous, and we're inside here talking about wrestling.
Fast. And SummerSlam's on later
today,
so we're doing a whole day wrestling thing.
You got it. No pre-show, though, thank you very much.
No pre-show. So, Cologne was wrestling in Calgary as Carlos Belafonte at the time, and apparently there was an argument
The Harry Belafonte estate. I guess he wasn't famous at this point. He'd entered in. Oh!
Yeah, that's why he had to flee the country.
Belafonte sent his goons after him. I'm sure that's entirely anachronistic. Anyways, just trying to add color here. I got nothing. I told you guys.
So there was an argument between Belafonte, Colon, and Rule in a car going to a show. And it was maybe over a woman, we're not sure. But what happened was that it ended up with Rule hitting his head hard on the ground after probably being punched
by
Colon.
Sure.
Hit his head on the cement, and I think he fractured his skull. And he was never the same again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was already 50 years old by this point, and it did some damage. He was also, you know, a guy who had a lot of power in the territory. And, you know, the old saying is, you know, the bigger you are, the harder you fall. There was a lot of guys probably who wanted to see him go down.
Sure.
Because he had a lot of control.
Mm-hmm.
So this sort of precipitated all that.
Wow.
And he basically left the business not too long after.
Mm-hmm.
I think he tried wrestling a bit, but he couldn't do it anymore. He went back to farming. And farmed, I believe, with his brother until the late 80s, and then he died December 21st, 1988, at the age of 68. Total forgotten man in not only Calgary wrestling, but pro wrestling as a whole.
Yeah, it sounds like a guy that was somewhat of a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's entirely accurate. Just a guy who was hands-on and involved in different aspects in keeping the thing going.
The rest of the Booker thing was common, you know, in the 60s, 70s. You had a lot of guys that I did both.
Yep. But it's obviously an important cog in the machine.
For sure. And they had success this time. There was ups and downs, of course, but you know, the late 60s, early 70s was a glory period for Stampede, and he was the booker at that time. So, yeah, that's Dave Rule. Definitely, again, like Sky High Lee, you can't check him out as far as footage is concerned. But a guy who deserves to be highlighted for his contributions to Stampede Wrestling.
Yeah, and here's my input here is I'm just thinking about those last farming years when he's working with his brother,
right,
and he's not quite the same, and they've got to work on this farm together. I've got some sort of a sitcom kind of lighter of Mice and Men where they've got to keep the animals in line, and it's called I always having trouble with the animals, and they've got to keep them in line, so it's called Rules. that's the show. Okay. See, I there you go. I'm providing something.
No, that's like that should have happened.
Yes, maybe it did.
Maybe it did. It was on CFCN, and you know, we just know about it.
I was gonna say more like an access,
okay, yeah, maybe not,
or like some sort of public television.
Yeah,
it's just really like there
was a pilot shot in the notes. It didn't
rules.
It was just repeated. The pilot was on TV for years.
We memorized it.
All right, okay. So I mentioned Sweet Daddy Siki already, so we'll get into his bio. A pretty big name in Stampede history. When I was a kid, or Travis and I were growing up in Calgary, there was a show called Sports at 11, which was a sports highlight show.
Yeah.
And one of the hosts was Mike Toth, and he would always reference Sweet Daddy Siki.
That's right.
Someone he always brought up talking about wrestling.
Yeah, Mike Toth is a great reporter. Mm-hmm. I always thought so. He's probably my favorite out of that whole Sports at 11 crew. He went on to bigger and better things. Yeah. He worked at Sportsnet for quite a while. I don't know what he's up to these days.
No idea.
Yeah, Sports at 11. If you guys can, just on a side note, I don't know how it would hold up to somebody who's not from Calgary.
Well, I'm sure a lot of cities, of course, have like...
Sure. Oh, yeah, they did. They had Sports Page out here in Vancouver, I hear.
Edmonton had their show, too. Yeah. What's his name that became...
Sokowski?
No, Dutchie.
Dutch, that's right, Detition. Zal, Canadian. We're talking Canadian sportscasters. Here's our new niche. We weren't small enough yet. We want to get into that.
Talking about Canadian sports.
Anyways, it was a big, really special night in Canada for those of you who don't know. Last night, when the Tragically Hip played their last concert, and it was simulcast all over CBC, our national network. I saw the New York Times had a really good write-up about it.
Okay.
It felt important. And it's weird. It's one of those things, right? Like, I don't know why I'm going off on this right now, but it's just when you see people kind of stop what they're doing, and that's outside of hockey or politics. There's, you know, nothing like that happens.
Oh yeah, iconic Canadian band.
Yeah, it was really cool.
We're so entrenched in Canadiana.
Yeah.
Next time we're gonna have maple syrup.
Yeah.
And pancakes.
Who knows what else we'll be talking about?
We'll be our accents will become more and more apparent.
Yeah.
With each passing episode. Yeah.
Sweet Daddy Siki. Looking at his pictures right now, like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, there's a star, man.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So Toth always referenced him, and I didn't know who that was, of course, you know, as a kid, but I knew he had been a famous name in the past in Stampede. And he has quite the story to him. Wikipedia has his birth date as June 16th, 1940, which I'm 99% certain is a work. Because digging deep or a little deeper into things, it looks like he was in the army in the early 1950s in the States and was about to go to Korea when the war ended. So I doubt he was involved.
15 years old.
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
so.
Or, yeah, 13, 14 years old. So he's obviously fudged his date later on in life. He was born in Montgomery, Texas. Real name, Reginald Siki. Maybe, I think that's his real name. Anyway, we'll say that it is. So, he started with this. Well, it seems like, I don't know, Siki seems like a made-up name, but maybe it wasn't a made-up name.
Huh, yeah.
he started wrestling around 1955. So again, if he was born in 1940, he would have been 15, which isn't to say you couldn't have started that young, and as some wrestlers have.
Sure.
Most likely, he was probably, let's say, 10 years younger than that, maybe.
Okay.
Or 10 years older.
10 years older, yeah.
Than his birth date on Wikipedia.
Hmm.
5 to 10 or so. First records I could find... Well, he started in New Mexico, which is pretty obscure. I'm not
Again,
sure what territory, what... how they fit into things at that time.
Just an offshoot of that Arizona.
Yeah, maybe. Just
crossing that border.
He wrestled in the Portland territory in the mid-50s as Reggie Seeky. And now he... this is where we live in Vancouver comes into play. He wrestled in Vancouver in 1956. So there's a lot of crossover with Portland. And
Do you
Vancouver.
Know the name of... What would it have been at that? It's an All-Star Wrestling?
I don't know if it was All-Star Wrestling then.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Like a lot of territories, they went through a lot of different names and often had different names at the same time. So it's hard to say. But Vancouver was a hotspot for wrestling by that time. And yeah, he was pretty much a Pacific Northwest guy during this time. Another obscure territory hit up in 1958 was the Utah-Idaho territory.
Hmm.
And then he made his way to LA.
I bet you curfews a lot earlier.
At the
Utah fights.
Yeah, wrestling at like 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
All right. Very boring territory.
Yeah.
And then from there he goes to LA, so quite the change. That's where he was first billed as Sweet Daddy Seeky. This was late 1958. He became a main eventer, basically, at this time. He was a babyface. He worked in Montreal, which was a hotbed for wrestling. And then by April 1960, he was wrestling for Capital Wrestling, which was Vince McMahon Sr.'s promotion. Of course, that's where he started in Washington, D.C., hence the name. By 1960, he was pretty established in the New York area. And Seeky was wrestling at MSG.
Wait a second. You're saying Sweet Daddy Seeky is associated with Washington, D.C.?
Vince Sr. was, he was based in Washington. That was where his wrestling promotion started. And then by 1960, Vince Sr. was kind of in charge of MSG in New York. So it was a long sort of process for him to take over the whole Northeast, actually. And then in 1960, Seeky was teaming with Bearcat Wright, another big black name at the time, as a tag team.
Good thing you finished that off with name. Another big black.
Yeah, I know. It could have went various different ways.
Okay, sorry.
They debuted at MSG May 21st, 1960. And he was part of the Northeast for most of the early 60s. There is a match out there from Chicago. There's a lot of Chicago footage from the 50s and 60s on YouTube, from the Chicago archives, film archives.
Yeah.
And one of them is, I believe it's Wright and Seeky against the Sicilians, who were Tony Altimore and Lou Albano.
Wow.
And the Sicilians, their gimmick was they were gangsters.
Mafia, yeah.
Yeah, mafia. But I haven't watched that.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Yeah, Albano. Shit.
It's in the footage quality is awesome, too, because it was well preserved.
Yeah, because in the archives. That's that's great to hear.
Yeah. So this was like early 60s was a hot period for wrestling in Chicago, New York. Seeky was in the mix here. He wrestled on a lot of shows. In Chicago, they were doing shows quite often at Comiskey Park, where the Chicago White Sox played. And the attendance there ranged from like 17,000 to 30,000 in 1960.
Wow.
So these were like the biggest crowds in wrestling at the time. Chicago was just on fire. He also teamed with Sailor R. Thomas, who was another black star at the time. A very big, muscular guy. He was part of stadium shows in Washington and Pittsburgh. So, like, in the early 60s, like, in this area of the states, a ton of stadium shows. Wrestling was red hot. Buddy Rogers was the big star for the territory at the time.
Okay.
The NWA
champion. Yeah, it sounds like he'd be in rarefied air at this point.
Yeah, he was like close, yeah. High mid card.
Who are like the contemporaries? Throw some names out that we might know.
Let's see. Well, Argentina Roca. This was like the heyday of, you know, that era for Vince Senior.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy Rogers, like I've also mentioned.
Yeah.
Freddie Blassie was a big name at this time.
Okay.
It was a hot period for Northeast wrestling. Based around like the drawing power of Buddy Rogers and Argentina Roca, especially, they were red hot stars at this time. Mm-hmm. And it really carried the territory. But then Siki went to Toronto in 1962.
Okay, before you hit that,
yeah,
where at what point did he record this album, Sweet Daddy Siki Squares Off with Country Music?
Right. Have you seen this? Yeah. Oh, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
He has quite a second career as a country and western singer and like a karaoke master.
The cover of this thing is fantastic, yeah, awesome. But probably incredibly racist. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about the guy he's talking to. He just looks a little kind of, for lack of a better term, zippity-doo-dah.
Song of the South. He recorded, I think, a couple albums. Late 60s, early 70s, I believe.
That's hilarious. This is fascinating.
Yeah, no, he's a fascinating character.
Yeah.
So in 1962, I went to Toronto, and it looks like this was where he first worked as a heel, doing his whole gimmick with the bleach blonde hair. Mr. Irresistible was his nickname. Here he teamed with Bulldog Brower, who we looked at on the first...
Bulldog? Yeah, Brower. Yes, Brower, of course. The 61.
From the 61 Stampede show, who was a huge heel at this time in Toronto. They
tried to give the slip to... I can't get over that.
I can't recommend that. That footage of Brower made up for all the crappy footage that we've had to watch on other Titan shows in the early 80s when he was definitely near the end.
I want to say, in your most recent Titans, you had, when Parvid asked you about how the footage stands up, you gotta pimp him that 61 thing if he hasn't watched it already.
I've tried Stampede and 1961 Stampede. That's a tough barrier.
But it's just minutes, man. You, these are the people who are sitting through, you know, hour long draws of Destroyer and Mill Masker you know, and Giant Baba.
It's a quick watch. I highly recommend it. You'll be pleasantly surprised.
All right.
But it's a tough sell. So him and Brower, Siki and Brower, held the international tag team titles. He was still wrestling in Vancouver at the time, but looks like he was still a face there. And speaking of stadium shows, they held a show at Empire Stadium. Yeah, which was the only result I could find for Empire Stadium for wrestling ever. And this was July
30th, 1962. Wow. The more you're talking about Vancouver, I think this could be a new kind of little project for us at some point here.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
That
now we're here, and it looks like we'd have the resources. We're just going to map it out as you guys listen right now.
Well, you talk about obscure territory.
Yeah,
Vancouver is very obscure. That show drew 16,000, so not bad. So then he did a bit of work here and there and came to Calgary around 1964.
Here we go.
And this was, you know, this is kind of looked at as his signature run.
Wow, even after all that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really cool to hear.
Yeah, Toronto too, because he went back and forth. But he was a very important part of Calgary's history as a top heel.
Great.
Where, like I mentioned, he feuded with Rule. They did all kind of gimmick matches. There was a boxing match between the two of them. That was one of the highlights. There was angles on TV, I think one where he actually put like the head of a pig around Rule's neck after a beatdown.
Oh, God, and I'm sure it wasn't a prop.
Christ. I think there was some other stuff, too, involving, like, dead animals. but, hey, it was a different time.
It's like, Rule's like, I got my farm over here. These things are just...
Yeah, exactly.
Just rotting away.
Might as well use them in an angle.
Oh, Gross.
But that's the kind of angle that Drew found.
Sure. That's crazy shit. You know the old adage, dead animal carcasses bleeds green.
I don't know. It was sort of in the pre-1980s era. It was like the better the angle, the better And something like that was just shocking. And so by this time, he was also, he was basically a heel everywhere. He worked in Montreal again. And then he returned to Stampede in 1970 and resumed his feud with Rule. But he also feuded with Dan Crawford, a young up-and-coming star, who I'll be talking about shortly. And that was his last year in Stampede. Oh, and he also feuded with Abdullah the Butcher that year, too. Abby feuded with everybody. didn't matter heel or face.
Yeah, we had said we were going to... We had contemplated talking about Abby a bit.
Yeah.
But I think there is a little bit more about him out there.
Well, as far as being a name beyond Stampede, he's quite a well-known name. And, you know...
Yeah, everywhere.
Japan.
Yeah, I love that Dick Murdoch match in Japan. Is,
1980. Oh,
good God.
I mean, Abby's like, you know, the quintessential bloody bad man of wrestling.
Yeah.
And, you know, he actually was a big star in Calgary.
How long was he there?
I think he started around 69, was big 70, 71, and then would make periodic returns afterwards. Because after that, he was in demand, and coming back to Calgary just wasn't practical for him, like, financially.
Sure.
Wasn't going to make as much money going to Calgary, and he was booked, you know, in most of the major territories in the world. So then
he was just kind of, he was kind of periodic.
Yeah.
For how long then?
He was
there into the 80s.
Yeah, '84 he was there after the whole controversy with Stomper and Bad News and that whole thing. He came back for at least a show at the Saddle Dome. And that's online. There's, I believe, a match with him from '84 at the Saddle Dome.
Cool.
One of the rare Stampede shows held at the Olympic Saddle Dome in Calgary.
Pengrowth. It would have been brand spanking new at that time. It's funny, they've been talking about getting it replaced forever with this new
complex
that has been
which would be great,
hitting all sorts of snags. Yeah, it looks amazing,
but doesn't sound like it's gonna happen anytime soon.
Yeah, and now starting to get a little pressure. The city of Calgary is getting pressure from Gary Bettman in the NHL to get her done.
Yeah, and well, McMahon Stadium, where the Stampeders of the CFL Canadian Football League play, definitely needs to be replaced because it's a fucking
How old is that, Billy?
It's plus 50 plus years. It's the oldest stadium in the league. Still.
Oh, really?
In existence,
more than Commonwealth?
Yeah, because Commonwealth's only from the late 70s.
Huh.
McMahon Stadium goes back. And it's funny, when I was a kid, I thought it was Vince McMahon. Was the McMahon behind the
Why doesn't he just hold shows
that
here?
Was the only McMahon I knew.
Well, I knew Ed McMahon. I think I knew Ed McMahon before I knew Vince McMahon.
Ed McMahon. But for whatever reason, well, being a wrestler.
Yeah. That's funny. He must have a ton of power. It must be widespread.
Okay, so for Siki, he totally slowed down after 1970. This is when he started cutting records. Mostly, I think it was all country and western.
Funny. I only see the one cover here. I'm going to look up Sweet Daddy Siki country albums.
Yeah, so he would do like bar shows and stuff as a country singer. Pretty much after 1970, he was exclusive just to Toronto. He never returned to Calgary. And every year after 1970, there was less and less matches. He does have a run in the Maritimes of Canada, in 1983-84 for Grand Prix Wrestling. And that there is matches on YouTube of that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe maybe the only Sweet Daddy Siki footage out there. He would have been probably near 50 at that time. I didn't watch them. It's studio wrestling. It looks, you know, it's marvelous in its quality.
Cool.
So I don't think it would really give you too much of a sense as to what he was at his peak.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? So yeah, if you're interested in the man, check that out. The last recorded match I could find for him was December 26, 1986 in Montreal. He's still heavily involved in wrestling. There's a periodic like wrestling conventions held in Toronto known as Titans in Toronto. The last one held in 2014, where it's like a reunion for all the old timers.
Kind of similar to Cauliflower.
Yeah, the Cauliflower Club. There's a whole bunch of different ones throughout the States. It looked cool. Like, I saw pictures from the one in 2014, Dominic DiNucci was there.
Oh, man.
That's where he got his start, or where he wrestled a lot.
Road trip! sounds yes. like a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Toronto's a great wrestling town. Man. Yeah. Like, serious history there. It's really one of the most important wrestling cities in North America, historically.
Hmm.
And to this day, I mean, they're mm-hmm. doing Survivor Series this year.
Finally, yeah, it's good.
Finally, a pay-per-view back in the Grand North.
Yeah, we don't even want to talk about how long it's been since Vancouver's had TV. And I think it's because they didn't sell out Raw like so many years ago. And right. that, and now Vince just holds this grudge.
Some strange avoidance of Vancouver.
But you always see that WrestleMania in Vancouver sign at every Mania. Somebody's pushing for it.
Yeah, he's from Victoria, that guy.
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I have a friend who's good friends
with
him. But that, I mean, they've released recently the list of names considered for future WrestleManias, and Toronto was on it, but Vancouver.
Yeah.
unfortunately, no.
Yeah, I'm looking at Sweet Daddy Siki's another album here. It's just self-titled. He's looking straight at the camera, holding a guitar.
Yeah, that's the other one.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Pretty great. Looks like a guy who knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
knows how to not only obviously play his instruments, but looks like he knows how to have a stage presence in that manner as well.
Yeah, no, the only song I could find of his on YouTube was Jambalaya.
Yeah, that's the one that I saw too here.
And it's pretty damn.
Yeah, cool.
So anyway, that's Sweet Daddy C.
Really, really cool looking guy.
You can see, just like...
I feel like if we did have more footage of his stuff, it would... I mean, it's totally presumptuous, but I feel like it would really stand up.
I don't think it's presumptuous, because the guy drew money.
Yeah.
He's a legend. I mean, obviously he was a star. Obviously people were attracted to him. And that's one of the reasons, or maybe the main reason I wanted to do a bio on
sure.
him, because he's a guy that I was like, you know, he would have been so great.
Yeah, it looks very ahead of his time.
I just would love to see these angles with Rule and the matches they had, and just the crowd response, you know, to him, and just
like, man. It's just just that look, you could, I feel like you could pick it up and place it anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And just even from these still photos, you just see oozing charisma. Yeah.
Because black wrestlers at the time were mostly baby faces, you know, Boba Brazil, and then the guys we mentioned. Well, Bearcat Wright did work as heel, but he was a big baby face star. Sailor Thomas was a big baby face star.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, part of the reason they were kept baby faces because they didn't want to run the risk of the heat getting a
huge
too
racist, understood,
with racist audience,
as we do see from time to time in the Calgary footage.
So that was when, so Siki was kind of a revolutionary as far as being like one of the first major black heels, top of the card guys. So he's definitely a name that deserves to be remembered. And lastly, but not least, is Dan Crawford. Maybe the biggest star, babyface star in the 70s for Calgary. We talked about him on the Stomper show. That was one of the lone matches.
Yeah, that we watched of Archie.
Not a lot of footage of Crawford. God, that may be it, actually. But
altogether?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because he didn't wrestle much outside of Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
And he did at a time before the, you know, the advent of the VCR and taping.
Is the Crawford in Can-Am Express related to him?
No, but he took the name as a tribute.
Cool.
Which it's confusing because he took his, like, he became Dan Crawford. He'd be Phil LaFon in the WWF.
Yeah.
With Doug Furness, a major tag team in Japan in the 90s. But he took the name as a direct tribute.
One of the best tag matches I've ever seen. That Kobashi and Kikuchu. Crazy crowd. Yeah, that's pretty well known.
But the original Dan Crawford was from Vancouver, born and raised. June the 14th, 1945 was his birthday. He was discovered by Earl Maynard, who was a bodybuilder and a former Mr. Universe. also a wrestler and an actor, kind of did a whole bunch of things. Crawford was working as a lifeguard in Vancouver when he was discovered by Maynard. And Maynard recommended him to Stu Hart. This is the late 60s.
Saw him running on the beach like David Hasselhoff. I just see it like clicking into slow motion. And
Crawford had he was a very good looking man. He was kind of like a Robert Redford-esque guy
at
the time.
Right. So that's how they would, at least that's how McCoy writes about him and Archie. So it's kind of like you got your Robert Redford and you got your Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, there you go. There's the perfect comparison right there. And of course, Redford was one of the major stars of Hollywood at the time. So Crawford had a great look. He was athletic. He went to Calgary and Stu trained him. And he must have been a pretty tough motherfucker because he survived Stu's training. And his first match...
Part of me wants to believe that once they get into the dungeon, Stu just cracks a couple beers and then asks everyone to just start screaming in bloody pain.
Yeah.
And and it's just been this great myth over the years.
I'm really not that tough.
I'm really actually quite a sweetheart.
I'm kind of a pussy.
I hate spiders. Things that just really put him off. But I love kitty cats.
Yeah.
That's what Teddy inherited. Did you see how he had Teddy Hart was at the NXT show with one of his cats?
Oh, really?
Looked like it was sitting in a like a big gulp glass or something from the picture that I saw. Another,
what a man.
So
Crawford, the first result I could find was September 19th, 1969. For his first few years, he was pretty much just enhancement talent. Lost pretty much all his matches. That's Crawford.
Yeah, not a lot of pictures for him, but you can see the. It's just because, I mean, part of it's because he gets mixed in with Phil LaFon.
It's totally led to a ton of confusion.
Sure.
So he had a run in Vancouver in 1970. Also in Portland, he wrestled with Danny Crawford in Portland. He returned to Calgary in 1971, and by this time was kind of a mid-card guy. Was in a lot of tag matches with various partners. Would hold the tag team titles in Calgary with Bill Cody.
The Wild Bill Cody?
Yes. There's a little known fact. Had him frozen in the bottom from somebody and brought him back.
It was a Weekend at Bernie's thing.
Yeah, just for a tag.
Thinking the money would drop. They love cowboys here in Calgary.
A little short-sighted of Stu not to make him a main event.
Yeah.
In 1972, Crawford was working in L.A. as King Crow. I'm assuming maybe this was a mask gimmick with that name.
Sure.
Because you would think, you know, why would you have a name like that if you weren't wearing a mask? But I'm not sure. There's no footage to assess that by. But when he returned to Stampede in the summer of 72, this was when he was given his big push as a main eventer. For the first time, won the North American title on August the 25th. And then he entered into a feud with Tor Kamada, someone I've made famous on Titans of Wrestling in the past. Big star in Calgary in the early 70s, his interactions with Ed Whalen.
Oh, is that the No Chancey?
Yeah. No Chance, Mr. Whalen. Which was, they had this running gag.
Yeah, that, my, I'll say this about my family. They are not wrestling fans at all. I'd say my brother had my younger brother had a time when he was into it, but it was just it's around that 97 time when everybody was, and even my sister kind of got into it during and before then and through the Attitude Era when everybody's watching. But now my sister has openly said to me how much she despises my love of wrestling right now.
Really?
But that being said. How much that No Chance Mr. Whalen was embedded in the Calgary vernacular, as my own mother would say it all the time.
Oh wow!
And she wasn't even a wrestling fan,
right? But she would have grown up in Calgary.
Yeah,
at the time.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It became a catchphrase.
Yeah.
It was quite well known. So Crawford and Kamada actually had the first ever ladder match in wrestling history together.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah. 1972.
It's just a lean-to ladder, right?
Yeah,
it's
just regular ladder.
Leaned up against the scaffolds, I guess?
No, it was a ladder.
Oh, no? Yeah, okay.
Am I thinking
of a different ladder match that was in Stampede?
I think that has been done.
Yeah.
If it wasn't Stampede,
it was somewhere, yeah.
Somewhere. Like you said, lean-to ladder in the corner. This was Crawford's idea. Apparently, he was, having some input at the time. And the original stipulation was that a bag of money was hanging from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
That was what they were climbing up to get. But apparently they did actually eventually have the North American title
being cool.
held up there.
They used that trope of a wad of cash hanging from the a lot in Calgary.
Oh, yeah.
Or a wad of cash being like given to the baby face.
Yep.
You'd throw it into the crowd.
Yep. Cash as a stipulation was a major part of a lot of stipulation matches in the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bret Hart, of course, was growing up at this time watching, and this was where he got the inspiration eventually.
Yeah, doesn't Bret said before that he had the first ladder match?
Technically, in the WWF, he did.
In the WWF. In the WWF.
Yeah, okay. 1992. Okay. And it wasn't on a main show. It was taped for one of the old, when they had the tapes
okay.
that they would put out.
Yeah.
And they'd have exclusive matches.
Hmm.
And it was on that. And it was his idea to bring it to
okay.
WWF.
Okay.
And eventually he wanted to use it on a bigger stage. And if you read his take on it, he's kind of bitter that it eventually when it did happen at WrestleMania.
It was
Michaels and Ramon and not...
Whoa, wait a second. You're saying Bret was kind of bitter? He was kind
of
bitter about something?
This is one of his minor little bits. It's true, though. The WWF hadn't had a ladder match before that.
Hmm, okay.
It had been used... When I was young and reading the wrestling mags in the 80s, there was definitely ladder matches happening because I remember seeing pictures of them. Like the AWA was one of the territories I can remember having them. But it wasn't anything that was like a big-time gimmick, that like a lumberjack match or a cage match that was, common. But, yes, the birthplace of the ladder match was in Alberta. I'm not sure if it was Calgary first. Technically, the first one I could find online, it happened in Lethbridge, October 30th, 1972. But actually, it probably happened in Calgary earlier.
Yeah.
And then it was, moved out to the other cities.
Lethbridge is one of the three medium-sized cities.
Yes.
Small to medium-sized cities in Alberta.
Yeah.
Calgary and Edmonton are the two bigger cities.
Yeah.
And you got Lethbridge, Medicine Hat, and Red Deer.
Yes.
As the kind of pseudo-urban centers in between and around Calgary and Edmonton.
I don't think... Unless it was when I was really young, I don't think I've ever been to Lethbridge. It's in southern Alberta.
I've been a couple times.
Yeah.
They have their university.
Yeah.
It was designed by Arthur Erickson, who also did SFU out here. It's weirdly enough, even though they're both use a ton of concrete, but those two schools have the highest suicide rates reportedly.
Oh, really?
One because one's buried in the hills, and the other one's SFU's on top of a mountain.
Right.
I've been to all those cities. I lived in Red Deer for 2 years. I went to theater school there.
I've been to Red Deer tons of times, of course, because it's in between
Calgary and Edmonton.
I've been to Medicine Hat tons of times, but now Lethbridge. When we did our vacations or whatever.
Yeah, it's never really en route.
You had to go kind of
unless you go to Montana or
going
something.
Down to Montana.
Yeah, yeah.
And we never did that.
Yeah.
As
who the hell goes to Montana? I did a couple times. I bought my Nintendo Entertainment System in Montana.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There you go, folks.
It's still a three plus hour drive from Calgary.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's as far as for our non-Canadian listeners going, or listening here. Calgary is unique in Canada as being like a major city that isn't close to the American border,
mm-hmm.
whereas most major cities in Canada
good
are close
point.
To the,
yeah.
like within like a short drive.
Sure.
Even Winnipeg isn't too far from Minnesota.
Hmm. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's about, 3+ hours, I would say.
Hmm.
So anyway, there was all kinds of feud. Oh, no. So after the feud with Kamada, he got into a feud with the Stomper. And this included bare knuckles matches, cage matches, all kinds of stuff. And he lost eventually a Loser Leaves Town match to someone named Gil Hayes, that unfortunately I don't know too much about.
Old Gil.
In October 1973, this is when he went to Tri-State Wrestling in the States, which was eventually it would kind of evolve into Mid-South Wrestling. You know, more familiar with that, the Bill Watts territory. So like Louisiana, Oklahoma, Mississippi, parts of Texas. This was kind of like his only, I wouldn't even call it a run of note. But he did bring the ladder match with him to Tri-State, apparently. So I think he was kind of pushed all
walked late. Into the office with
yeah.
it.
Yeah, here we go.
Here's my resume.
Yeah, here's my resume.
Slams it down on the desk.
But it's kind of cool that he brought the idea with him, and maybe that started it, you know, maybe starting
sure.
from there.
Sure.
Who knows?
Hmm.
I think he was maybe at least a mid-carder at this time. He went back to Vancouver, but he didn't return to Stampede until early 1975. And this is kind of his last major run in Stampede. And it's an infamous run where there was the big feud was this bloody gang war between these two sides. On one side was Crawford. And a wrestler named Mark Lewin, who's pretty well known as far as a guy who wrestled in a lot of different territories mm-hmm. over the years.
Would I know him by another name?
In the 80s, he was part of Kevin Sullivan's Army of Darkness.
Darkness Kit.
The Purple Haze.
Yeah, okay.
In there, where he had his eyes rolled in the back of his head okay. sort of thing. But he wrestled all over the place for years and years. Anyway, the main feud was Lewin and a wrestler named King Curtis Iakea, who is pretty well known, had different runs in different territories over the years. He was a manager briefly in the 80s in WWF for Kamala. And anyway, their feud was that they would go from these different territories and have these bloody wars where it'd be in Australia, they were on the same side and they were against a wrestler named Big Bad John and his army. And basically, it was just like bloodbath wars.
Wow.
You know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And they brought it to Calgary in 1975. And it was Lewin, Crawford, and Larry Lane. And Lane was a top babyface in Calgary at the time. He's a controversial figure. A lot of people didn't like him. He was put on top later. And the territory sort of nosedived under him as on top.
Hmm.
And he kind of has a reputation as being kind of a dick behind the scenes. Anyway, that was the babyface side. The heel side was Curtis Iakea, John Quinn, he's the Kentucky Butcher in the 60s. Big wrestler. Mr. Hito was another member of the heel side. And the Sheik, the original Sheik,
wow.
Was actually brought in at this time for his only one and only run in Calgary. This was controversial because it was very bloody, and it got to the point where Ed Whalen was fed up and quit.
So this is
one of the times he quit was here, because you know the matches had just got to the point where the whole point of the matches was just to see how much blood
Jesus
draw out.
Who's and this Stu is booking at this point.
I'm not sure who was. I think actually Lewin was booking.
Yeah.
Because Lewin was a booker. And like I said, he would go from area to area. They ran this feud in Australia. They ran this feud in Detroit. I think they ran it in Amarillo, Texas, which was a territory at the time. And they just did the same thing. And it did big business at first because people loved to see these bloodbaths. But after a while, when every match is bloody, it's like it's not special anymore, right? And the pattern is, I think, identical with every territory, is that eventually, when they left, attendance was way down, and each territory had to struggle to rebuild their attendance after these programs rent.
Hmm.
But it was a very, it was a famous, it was sort of like a quintessential 70s program.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they would draw.
Yeah.
But then.
The freak aspect. The
yeah.
aspect.
But then. Because of did the crowds come to expect this?
You get burnt out,
or it's yeah. just like, good God, what the hell's become of you? I'm
yeah.
gonna skip next week.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like where the first time you see it, it's novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's
sure. Just like anything. Yeah.
But then when you realize there's no progression and it's
mm-hmm.
just, this is just what they're doing
mm-hmm.
nonstop, then the fans lose interest. And
it happens. It happens, right?
Calgary went through
ECW.
After that feud, it took until Dynamite Kid and Bruce Hart or Bret Hart and all the young high flyers started going to sort of revitalize Stampede. So Crawford totally slowed down, sporadic appearances in 77, a few matches in 1980, and he did return in 1985 when Stampede came back after the whole Vince McMahon buying the territory and then giving the territory back thing. And he actually feuded with Honky Tonk Wayne, who would become
Honky Tonk Man.
So this must have been right before I started wrestling, because I don't have a memory of Crawford.
Yeah.
But it's not to say he wasn't there. Because I know I got into it when Honky Tonk Wayne was the push top heel.
What's Jason the Terrible's real name?
Moffat.
Moffat, yeah, that's Moffat. Right, that's right.
Yeah,
I was getting
another confused. Lastly, one last story. Post-wrestling, he worked as a prison guard on Vancouver Island in Saanich, which is just north a bit of Victoria.
First Nations Reservation.
Yeah, and it's basically part of the Great
Land,
Victoria. And he was involved in a hostage-taking situation at the prison where some prisoner somehow gained control. I think probably maybe a group. And, a gun had been smuggled into the prison. That was what happened. And it got into the hands of a prisoner. And, there's actually a video that he made afterwards of, how do you handle a situation like this? It got a lot of note in the Victoria press at the time. Because it went on for a few days, I think, where there's this, hostage situation in prison.
Wow.
But he was shot, I think, actually, in the whole situation.
Jesus.
But, that was sort of like his one big post-wrestling story. And then he went back to Calgary and opened up a car dealership.
Okay. And here I have found a recent Dan Crawford story from November 26, 2015. I think he's in Cochrane now, which is just outside of... of Calgary.
Yeah.
And there's a, this is from the CochraneTimes.com. So I guess he must be just a known, maybe this isn't indicative of what he's really doing right now, but he's philanthropy. It looks like, so in Cochrane, I think we heard about some of this around all over Canada, or at least they were, people were posting about it on social media that, poppies were getting stolen. Boxes are like the changes. Poppies. We have a November 11th in Canada as Remembrance Day, and we all wear poppies. And you buy them at they're always just these little boxes are just set up by the veterans or the legions of Canada.
So people were stealing the donations.
Yeah, and people just take the donation boxes. And it was starting a lot of just getting people pissed off. Like, who are these kids?
Yeah.
But so it looks like he ran a campaign with Calgary Stampeder running back John Cornish to a 1 week blitz to make up for the stolen poppy funds in Calgary and area. It looks like they wanted to raise $2,000 and they beat their goal and got to $2,200. I'm certain this is him, right?
Yeah.
This looks like older him. Yeah. So it shows you this guy is still playing the baby face out there and living the lifestyle. That is cool.
Yeah.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO-PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Great, well, I'm done with my guy.
So that leads us to, so I think from here on in, our next episode, I think we're going to, we've put it off long enough. Yeah. I think we're going to get to the network footage that was pulled. Mm-hmm. And it will have some of who we're talking about now, as well as when we look at our memorable angle. But mm-hmm. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't spend some time at least talking about Dynamite Kid, who... when you look at, I think you can really, there's a pre-Dynamite era and there's a post-Dynamite mm-hmm. era, as we'll see here, because he just really stands out and would really bring the best out of work rate into Stampede Wrestling, right?
Yeah.
Is that
fair? Enter work rate, enter like speeding things up.
Yeah.
Like that was, and we watched a few matches earlier, that was like the main thing, like Ed was pointing out was how fast-paced this was. And, you know, if you're familiar with wrestling as a whole in the early 80s, it was a lot slower. It was great,
mm-hmm.
but there was a lot of guys that, you know, you watch these matches and they're just in slow motion. And guys like Dynamite, it was
revelation.
It was a revelation. Yeah. It was revolutionary. It was athleticism that hadn't really been seen in that way in wrestling before.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to start with a match that Kelly thought we'd be looking at around 1981-ish mm-hmm. between Dynamite Kid and Young David, looking like Young David, but he is going by the name of Davey Boy Smith for the North American strap. So we, again, as always with a Stampede match, we cut to late in the match, and you can tell this crowd is so hot for this mm-hmm. match. And referee J.R. Foley is involved, who we talked about a bit in the Stomper matches. Right away, he's causing shit with his cane. He just kind of sits, like he sits kind of innocently in that chair, but then is always getting involved. They had the same start to the match we follow up here, Foley doing the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it starts with Davey Boy's outside, and we see a really kind of stiff kick from Dynamite to the outside into the ring there. And a ton of just like, I describe it as like a vicious fire from Dynamite.
Yeah.
And he's... you see that he's selling a knee from earlier, so you can tell that he's taking in that long-term psychology. Mm-hmm. Great action. Sunset flips aplenty. Really hot pavilion. Dynamite, he pulls Davey Boy up after a two count, which even Eddie thinks might have been a bit presumptuous.
Yeah.
So and this leads to this finish where it's important. Davey Boy wins. And right away, it's like he's like he had this ready to go in his back pocket should this occur. Yes. Dynamite Kid stiffly drop kicks referee Sandy Scott, like really kind of hits him hard and pumps him out of the ring. And then like immediately goes to grab him and points to Davey Boy Smith and blames it on him, which watching this in a vacuum feels like a bit of a flimsy finish. So like, oh, of course I'll side with you. So he ends up giving the match to Dynamite, and Dynamite retains. And there's a quick promo from Davey Boy, and then a really great heel promo from Dynamite, really quick, how he just says, "I won that match fair and square." Like, just really, really hits it home. So we do kind of get to know the character of Sandy Scott in this next match that we see. But that was... do you have anything to add to
I mentioned this while we were watching, is that Marty and I had tag teams back again. I've been watching a lot of late 80s Bulldogs and post back injury.
Yeah, and we will look at one of his here too.
Yeah, Dynamite, and you know, he is basically limited and kind of a shell of his former self, because you look at this early 80s stuff and he's just flying all over. And then I can contrast it with the Titans footage from the early 80s when you have guys like Chief J. Strongbow and all the slower guys, Ferenc Kluna. This was just, you know, so revolutionary at the time, so fast-paced. And these guys came from England that in the 70s, this, you know, in England...
A world of sport.
Yeah, world of sport. And you had this sort of, you know, revolution of these smaller workers. I mean, in English wrestling, they had weight classes. They always had these weight classes. Whereas North American wrestling was mostly focused on the heavyweights. And, you know, some territories had junior heavyweights and that. But England really had a separation of weight classes where the lower weights were actually more important or more over with the fans. And this is the environment that Dynamite came up in as a kid and how he learned. And he brought that, you know, Bruce Hart.
Is it just based more on, like, those matches having a higher entertainment value, would you say?
I think for casual wrestling fans, you know, fast-paced wrestling is more appealing than the nuanced, psychological-based wrestling that you have to be patient for a lot to see a payoff.
Okay, if there's one match from 2016 you're going to show to non-fans, it's Ricochet and Ospreay, for sure.
That would be one, or Kota Ibushi and Cedric
Alexander
not too long ago. Yep. Something like that, you know, a New Japan style match.
Yeah.
So that was that, you know, and that's, it's very exciting. If you're more of a hardcore fan, you may be hung up on the lack of storytelling.
Yeah. And you're going to have a built-in little more patience, let's say.
Yes, and, you know, it's you know, very, and it's very appealing when you're young and you're very into that sort of stuff. You know, when I was younger as a wrestling fan, this stuff, it would be the what Dynamite, you know, influence later in the 90s with guys like Benoit and Guerrero and Malenko and the WCW guys and the ECW guys.
I can't think of two wrestlers where there's a more direct influence from Dynamite Kid and Chris Benoit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Benoit has some other things, but you just see so much.
Benoit was from Edmonton and he fell in love with Dynamite Kid and modeled himself after him as a wrestler and appearance-wise.
Yeah,
too.
Big time,
So, yeah, Dynamite had a huge influence. Tiger Mask in Japan, too. And the two of them would have a legendary feud that would, you know, the tapes of that would start getting circulated in the States. And so, you know, Dynamite's looked at as a pretty influential guy, revolutionary guy. The PWO crowd that, you know, I frequent, they're kind of down on Dynamite, you know, as far as being the guy who, you know, didn't have much psychology, didn't sell. It was all go, go, go. And, you know, he kind of led to this style of wrestling that a lot of people aren't too interested in. But
I don't know. I don't see. I mean, obviously we see go, go, go here.
Yeah.
But we're seeing really great character work. And we see some, like, killer selling in this next
match. Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I think the criticisms of Dynamite Kid are very overblown.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot more to him than just high spots.
Sure.
That's for sure. And okay. this match was cool. I don't think I'd seen this before.
Cool. Yeah. The finish with Sandy Scott comes out of nowhere quickly.
Yeah,
totally. It's just like, whoa.
The drop kick. Yeah, stiff.
Right to the back. Give it a whiplash, you said. So we go back in time to against Bruce Hart from 1980. This is the best 2 out of 3 falls. We're already one fall in where Dynamite is one. J.R. Foley's in his same spot doing the same thing to start it off. So here we start to see Dynamite's like really great selling off of like a turnbuckle, making Bruce look like $1 million.
Yeah.
Until finally Bruce hits a pin after a flying clothesline. Mm-hmm. I will say this. I really loved Bruce looks like he's just putting like a ton of effort into his moves here and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the way he kind of goes down to a knee on that the Irish whip into the corner.
Yeah,
it was good. So I noticed that this place where we first noticed that Ed's really selling it. They have an official NWA ref and Sandy Scott is at ringside.
Yeah.
So this is, as we said, this is before the match we saw where Sandy Scott came off as inept. But I think this may have been when we're introduced to Sandy Scott's ineptness or just some sort of establishment that he is this heel.
Yeah, ref. Scott as a ref leaned towards the heels, made a bunch of like favorable calls toward the heel. I'm assuming the build to this match was that he was the ref in a match between... Mm-hmm. Kid and Bruce, and there was a controversial finish, perhaps multiple ones, and it was like, okay, we got to
this
get
felt like a,
an outside official.
A blow-off match, would you...
Yeah, I mean, these two guys worked a lot together. There's more than just that out there for these two guys. It's amongst my favorite Stampede stuff is Bruce Hart against Dynamite Kid.
So Dynamite's are showing a really fiery comeback, and that... You can see when he's upping his energy that Bruce is just almost involuntarily upping his energy to match it. And that's a sign of a great wrestler who's bringing out the best in the people he works with.
For sure.
We see that classic flying headbutt miss. And then Bruce misses with a weird knee drop from off the top rope that looked like it could have caused some damage to himself. And you see a really good tone shift in the from this high, because this is later in this 2 out of 3 falls match. It turns into this kind of the exhausted strikes that you tend to see in these longer matches. Scott grabs the mic here and talks about how he's upset that he should be in there.
Yeah.
We see a ref bump, and then he makes the pin, but then Scott points out that Dynamite Kid's leg was under the ropes.
Yeah.
And the crowd is angry, right up against the ring, and they're like pounding against it, like just slapping on like it's young and old, like all ages, all sexes are all like in total unison outrage. That this no, he's got to win this match. So huge heat, and it leads to. So Sandy Scott comes in and gets him to reverse the decision. And before Bruce Hart can even figure out what's going on, Dynamite hits a German suplex and gets the pin.
Yeah.
And you're just hearing, at this point, just women screaming from the crowd. And even more heat than you could even imagine. They're still pounding on the thing. And this is great. After Dynamite has left the ring with Foley and everybody, Scott and Bruce is just sitting there by himself. Scott goes over to kind of shake his hand, and the crowd is like, "You've got to be fucking kidding me!" And the crowd just like, this is their catharsis. If Dynamite walks away from this this night still the champ, the crowd still got to see the ref get his come up, and since Bruce just pounding the crap out of him.
The heel gets to keep the title, but the crowd gets a reward at the end with Scott getting pounded on by Bruce Hart, which I'm imagining must have been like months
like kind of a blow off.
Who knows how long.
In some form or another.
Yeah.
So that was again a really fun Dynamite match for what we got to see from it. So now we cut to similarly to what Marty and you said are looking to seeing Dynamite post back injury in a street fight 1989 against Owen Hart. At this point, I think it really clued in on me what I've been wanting to say about Dynamite for a while is that he has a great hooligan look, like that kind of soccer hooligan, totally. Kind of like you can just imagine him headbutting people for kicks.
Or like in punk rock shows in the late 70s.
Yeah.
Spitting on the band.
Yes. yes, totally. What's that? So this is like, and I think he even had it, he had kind of perfected that look, even though it was working in the early 80s. Even this is post, so maybe he's trying to kind of up it here with these Zubas and tank top, and he has sunglasses, we'll see later in that that 87 footage, that I think even just in terms of playing the part of hooligan, if he's not able to kind of kind of do what he could in the ring, like he's
right,
making up for it in some ways
here. Because there was the big heel turn finally, like the Bulldogs had come back to Calgary in late 88 after their run in WWF and were still baby faces and got the heroes welcome and all that, but a few months later they finally split the Bulldogs up and Dynamite went heel and teamed up with Johnny Smith, who was the cousin of Davey Boy Smith, and they were the British Bruisers.
I'm
not sure.
I think they look alike, but I had heard that they were.
It could be kayfabe. I'm honestly, I don't know. Yeah. But they were at least billed as cousins.
Mm-hmm. So we learned right away in this match that Waylon is handcuffed to Abdul Weasel, who is Dynamite.
They would go through like a number of those heel weasel type matches.
Yeah, and this is your kind of playing your Arab Sultan. Kind of. Whatever.
Oil, yeah.
OPEC, something.
I don't know what it was. Yeah. It was a mix of a whole bunch of different racial tropes.
See, Owen is busted open. Dynamite Kid was still selling hard. Even though he couldn't flip as much as he could against Bruce, you're still seeing him just like making Owen's moves look harsh.
Yeah.
Owen hits a pile driver on the outside of the ring, which is like, this is a street fight, no rules match in 89, if we didn't mention. And that's point right away, Dynamite got a crimson mask. Another little shout out to our Calgary upbringing is Owen is a street fight, as goes, you're always wearing your clothes. Owen's wearing kind of wrapped around his waist is an AM 106 shirt. That was the top 40 station, if you can believe it, a top 40 station on AM in the 80s.
FM at that, I never listened to
FM radio. Me neither. It was all AM weird. We would like, that was really, that started my love of, or aided in me loving popular music more than that,
because
there
was top 10 at 10,
the top 6 at 6 and the top 10 at 10.
Yeah, and also Rick D's weekly top 40 was on that station.
I remember I would listen, I would read my just like all those Nintendo fun books or whatever I had while listening to the top 10 at 10, or my Spider-Man comics or whatever it was I had late at night in my room. So that was a cool kind of nostalgia pop for us.
More nostalgia.
And Dynamite creates a ref bump, which I don't know why this was necessary if this is a street fight, because it's even then.
Well, I guess with Smith's interference, but yeah.
But Smith, Smith interferes here and kicks ass. It hits a pile driver on Owen. Weasel grabs the mic here from Ed saying he's going to do it, and you keep hearing him going, Dynamite! Dynamite! throughout the thing. And Smith interferes again, but right in front of the ref, so that kind of negated the need for that ref bump. That was a little weird. And Owen, after this, after hitting with knuckle dusters, after hitting DK with these brass knucks, or knuckle dusters as Eddie used to call them, Owen wins with a small package, which is interesting. I'm still going to do this.
It
could have just kind of fallen on the lifeless body. So it was, I guess here you're seeing, he's still definitely effective. He's not working the same match. But even like Owen wasn't working his standard of Stampede wrestling. It's a street fight, so it is not going to be as high flyery.
There was the high flying. It was a good balance of both. It was true to their characters. Dynamite looked better here than he has in like the 87-88 footage I've been watching. And the crowd was hot, and they had the stip with Ed being chained to Weasel. And like I said at the end after it was over, is like, I wish this had been the final Stampede show. Like, it was a good high point. Babyface wins against the heel, and with Ed being involved.
Sure.
It would have been a good high point, because this was the summer of 89, and promotion goes on until December.
So, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good to know. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, I guess that's it for this week.
Yeah.
If like I said, next week we're finally going to get to that network footage. So you guys should be able to kind of follow along with us as well. I mean, you can still look up these the matches that we did talk about here. They're pretty easy to find.
Yeah, they're available. The Stampede footage I will make available on PWO for sure, because we have it as like sort of an under the table sort of thing. Because it was, you know, for those who have the network, it was on there for a couple days and then pulled down. There's six episodes, so it may take a couple shows to go through it all. We'll
I think we'll be able to get through it. I think we're going to get this. This is good for kind of getting a snapshot / time capsule kind of thing of what it was on a weekly basis moods and characters.
Yeah, because so far we've mostly, you know, done bios and done the history, and we haven't, you know, really examined a ton of footage or the week to week stuff. Mm-hmm.
And it's important for us to kind of show that this was the nightly stop for everybody, and this was the our afternoons. We're watching this.
Yeah, I'm it was super part of the routine. Yep. Like I watched a little bit of the one episode when it was on the network, but I haven't watched anything else.
Great.
So
yeah.
I'm hyped for this footage.
It's it's uneven. It's uneven. It looks great. It looks great.
Yeah, master tapes. Yeah. So it's
that's what I think. I think we will be able to get through it in one show, just because of how uneven it is, and a lot of it. I don't want to say it doesn't merit a lot of talking about. Let's just you start to see where people have issue with where Ed was cutting and editing, and why keeping certain things in and taking stuff out.
And it's six random episodes. It's not like it's telling. I don't think.
Yeah,
it's,
I feel like it's over. It's not week to week. It's just kind of over the course of a year.
Yeah.
So. But we'll get a good idea for how things were at that time.
Yeah.
So Kelly, you said there was some stuff you wanted to
push. I'll throw out the next tag teams back again with Marty Sleaze and myself. Will be recorded in a few days. Mm-hmm. We are now into 1988, and this episode will be heavy on Demolition, because this is when they ascend the throne for the first time in the tag team ranks. So that's pretty much the only one I really want to focus on, because there's a whole bunch of other stuff kind of here and there and stuff, but I could go on forever. But that's the most immediate one coming up.
Cool.
So check it out.
Cool. I should also mention that I did, I was telling Kelly earlier today, I booked a commercial. I shot a commercial recently. I won't tell you what product it's for, but I will say it'll be sliding your way shortly. Within the next couple months, you guys will be able to put a goofy face to this goofy voice.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny's a thespian on Titans of Wrestling, and Travis is a thespian. We got a good acting troupe going here.
Yeah.
You guys should get together sometime and do a play.
A radio play across
across
borders. That's a good idea.
Yeah, some radio theater.
Yeah, I like it. excellent. If there's nothing else for you to add, then that'll be it. In the meantime and in between time, that's it. Another edition of Stampede Wrestling. Bye now.
Tonight at 8, Sydney looks for a job on 60-something, and Morag sings All Grown Up next year on the Comedy Mill. At 8:30, Steve Allen helps Super Dave make a music video. And at 9, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling enter the ring, rapping and wrestling on GLOW.
Sing a little bit of working man blues. I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. Might get a little tight on the weekend after I draw my pay, but I go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank my beer at a tavern and sing a little bit of them working man blues. Here we go. Sometimes I think about leaving, do a little bump around. Throw my bills out the window, catch me train to another town, but I go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew.
better them words.